KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on the authors of the book Property Outlaws, How Squatters, Pirates, and Protesters Improve the Law of Ownership, written by professors Eduardo Penalver and Sonia Cotyell. This book is a really valuable contribution to a body of writing that has existed for quite a while, but certainly has gotten prominence over the last 10 or 15 years, and that boils down to the area that focuses on copyright violations and alleged violations and what the law should do about those ideas and those potential problems. In Property Outlaws, they take a very close look at the issues surrounding this behavior from the perspective of what you might call lawbreaking over the years, but more specifically, we could say challenges to behaviors that have been backed by law that have been viewed as socially, morally, or ethically, and ultimately legally incorrect. So Sonia and Eduardo begin their book with a reference to a particular event that occurred in Greensboro, where Elon's located, at least the law school's located, involving the lunch counter protest at Woolworths in downtown Greensboro that began ultimately a major movement that resulted in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That jumping-off point allows Eduardo and Sonia to take a closer look at property outlaws, and with reference to squatters, pirates, and protesters, we're looking at that behavior from a property perspective. And in going through this history, the authors of this book take an interesting area and come to a conclusion that might be counterintuitive to some, which is that this behavior not only improves the law of ownership, but I think, and I'll certainly ask the authors about this, are ultimately necessary, perhaps, to improve the law. So Eduardo and Sonia have written a terrific book here, and I'm really excited to have them on the show. By way of very brief background before we begin our discussion, Eduardo Penalver joined the Cornell faculty in 2006 after teaching at Fordham Law School and has visited at Yale. He is an alum of Cornell University, as am I, but I put that out as a caveat and a disclosure, but I promise to ask the same questions that I normally would, even though I have a bias for Cornell. He clerked for Judge Guido Calabresi in the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit and on the Supreme Court for Justice John Paul Stevens. With respect to Sonia, Sonia is at Fordham University. She teaches IP, property, and civil rights. She was an associate specializing in IP litigation in the San Francisco office of Covington and Burling. I won't hold it against her, but she is an alum of Brown University. Got her JD from University of Chicago Law School. She clerked for the Honorable Carlos Moreno, now a California Supreme Court Justice in the Central District of California from 98 to 99, and the Honorable Dorothy Nelson, the U.S. Court of Appeals on the Ninth Circuit from 99 to 2000. I'm very excited to have Eduardo and Sonia on the show, and thank you both for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks, David.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Let's start off, and Sonia, I'll start with you, and I'll ask the same question of Eduardo. Sonia, how did you become interested in the topic of property outlaws?
Part of the genesis for the book really came from the fact that Eduardo and I had basically offices right next to each other at Fordham for a number of years, some of my favorite years at Fordham. And at the time I was working on a piece that had to do with artistic disobedience. And Eduardo and I had, I was talking to Eduardo about that particular piece. It dealt a little bit more with copyright law and artistic expression. And it also occurred to both of us during that time that the same narrative that applied to the frameworks of copyright disobedience sort of loosely applied to the frameworks of real property disobedience, in the sense that both Eduardo and I teach real property, and you know, one of our big sections that we teach is adverse possession, where the law, in fact, has shifted to embrace individuals who challenge concepts of property ownership. So that actually sparked us in terms of having a number of different conversations about how the trajectory of challenging individuals challenging the law, property concepts, property ownership concepts in specific circumstances actually led to some very formative changes in the law. And we're really familiar with that narrative when it comes to our history of civil disobedience around civil rights. It's certainly a narrative where individuals like those who engage in the lunch counter sit-ins and so on are given, or they're certainly venerated in the law. But other individuals who also challenge concepts of property ownership are not. And so I think Eduardo and I were both really interested in looking at those alternative stories and demonstrating that some of those stories also led to really productive shifts in the law.
Yeah, that's right. And we, I think, in some ways, people are more used to hearing about this in the IP context. I think there is this discourse about, disobedience and fair use that's more prevalent in that scholarship. Where in the, I think it was sort of surprising when you find these patterns in the law of tangible property, because of the assumption that, well, tangible property being rivalrous in its consumption is not as susceptible to where disobedience in that context seems more damaging to owners than it necessarily is in the IP context. So I think it was very much a conversation that moved from a conversation about IP to a conversation about tangible property and finding patterns in tangible property that really emerged out of Sonia's insights in the world of IP. One of the interesting things about the phenomenon in the tangible property context is this kind of canonization that Sonia mentioned of the civil rights protesters in 1960, but at the same time a kind of very general distaste for tangible property disobedience as a whole. And so trying to identify why we kind of in our sort of historical consciousness privilege one group over others in terms of how we assess their disobedience, I think was an important part of the conversation as well.
You know, it's interesting, and I wanted to get into this, and so this is a good opportunity to do it. The contrast between real property and intellectual property is one that one would think is a common connection, and yet while you do see overlap among IP scholars and property scholars, it doesn't appear to me, and I haven't been at this that long, but it doesn't appear to me that real property scholars and IP scholars, which is arguably a form of property, although some people think it shouldn't be, talk that much. I don't see as much interaction, and I certainly haven't canvassed every IP professor in the country, but I don't know that there's a majority or even close to it of IP professors that also teach the traditional first year property course. Any reflection on that? Because both of you teach both IP and property, and for those that haven't been to law school, property is a standard first year course, and probably at every law school in the country. And IP is an upper level elective, although some schools emphasize intellectual property more than others. And any reflecting on the conversations or lack thereof between real property and IP professors?
Well, one thing that often strikes me, and I agree with you, there aren't as many people who teach both property and IP classes as you might think, given that there are so many powerful connections between these two areas of law. But one thing that has always really struck me about IP and IP professors is that most people who are intellectual property aficionados tend to be individuals that are drawn to IP through some other lens. And that other lens can be something like technology, that other lens can be something like art, that other lens can be, you know, computer science or, you know, administrative law. And there aren't that many individuals that are drawn to the world of IP through the lens of property law. And I think, you know, I agree with you in the sense that I think that there is a need for a longer and fuller conversation between real property experts like Eduardo and people who work on intellectual property like me, because I've learned so much from Eduardo's work on land use, for example, and it's given me a lot of insight into how we can approach the same questions in intellectual property. But I have to say, part of the reason why I've learned so much is because, you know, Eduardo and I had offices right next to each other, and so we were constantly having these conversations. And I, you know, I think that I felt lucky and that I benefited from those conversations in a way that I'm not sure most intellectual property law professors have that same kind of exposure.
Yeah, I think part of the reason there are so few, or maybe, you know, why more people don't teach both is that each field in itself is sort of a field with pretty high barriers to entry. So, I mean, property, I think, is one of the more daunting first-year courses just because of the number of doctrines and the breadth of the course. And I think IP is, you know, the statutory framework, I think, is a little bit intimidating to people who don't sort of enter the legal academy through that door. So it... I think that may explain why there's less dialogue, you know, than you would think, than there should be, I suppose.
Yeah, it's one of those things that just has struck me, you know, being a law professor for a few years. I've taught civil procedure, and I currently teach contracts, and I just tend to find that there are a lot more people teaching both of those courses, at least for the people I run into that do IP than property. And anecdotally, you know, I will hear IP professors from time to time say, "Oh my God, I never want to teach property." It's just it's an interesting overlap that would seem to exist. And yet doesn't exist quite as much. Before we get into the book, there is one other background question I wanted to ask both of you. Since both of you clerked, I was curious how and if your clerkships influence your scholarship. And perhaps, Eduardo, I'll start with you.
Well, I clerked for, you know, probably the judge who's got the highest percentage of former clerks in teaching at this point. I think when I go to the reunions, it feels like about 80% of the clerks are now teaching. And I can't say that there was a substantive impact on my scholarship, except that I think when it came time for me to assess whether I was going to stay at my law firm, the thought or the sort of possibility of teaching loomed larger than it might have been. So the fact that I have any scholarship at all, I think I maybe attribute to my Court of Appeals clerkship. Mm-hmm. I can't say. You know, the Supreme Court clerkship, I think, had a kind of a negative impact on my scholarship, not because of anything with Justice Stevens, who I love, but the court as an institution I found sufficiently kind of off-putting that it. I think that pushed me away from the typical former Supreme Court clerk focus on constitutional law, which I've not really ever – I mean, I do a little bit on takings and stuff, but I've kind of stayed away from constitutional law, I think, because I just was a little disillusioned by the Supreme Court. So those are kind of indirect impacts on scholarship.
Mm-hmm. Sonia?
Yes. For me, so my two clerkships, the first one was with Carlos Moreno, who's now on the Supreme Court of California. And I have to say, I do think that working for him probably influenced my scholarship in ways that I continue to be surprised by. He was someone I clerked for. It was his first year on the federal bench when I clerked for him. And I think that in many ways, his approach to judging, he has a very sort of Zen-like style of making decisions. And he's extremely comprehensive, but also really willing to allow clerks a lot of latitude in terms of arguing specific approaches and things like that. And so I think I learned a lot about kind of judging with integrity and judging with a sense of really understanding the ideal outcome for both parties. And the reason I say that is because in our last chapter of the book, we talk about same-sex marriage with a special eye towards the developments of Proposition 8 in San Francisco. And many of the opinions that we spotlight in that particular chapter were actually written by Justice Carlos Moreno. And he was, you know, one of the few justices to dissent from the last ruling, kind of upholding Proposition 8, and also had a number of really helpful and insightful points about the disobedience trajectory of Gavin Newsom in deciding to marry couples in 2004, and so. I think that in so many ways that chapter has his imprint all over it, in the sense of really standing up for certain things that you felt were right and that the law allowed.
We're chatting with Ed Warner. Do you want to jump in? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I thought you did. We're chatting with Professors Eduardo Penalver and Sonia Kotyal on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture, discussing their book Property Outlaws, How Squatters, Pirates, and Protesters Improve the Law of Ownership. And I should add that they are joining us via Skype from their respective homes in New York. With regard to the title, and I mentioned a bit about it in the introduction, but the turn towards the book, and I think, Sonia, you began a transition there. What do you mean, and I think Property Outlaws is obviously directly connected with the subtitle, but perhaps you could define the term. What do you mean by an outlaw in this context?
Maybe, Eduardo, do you want to take that one?
Well, so we distinguish in the book between outlaws and what we call alt-laws, and I think the outlaw term is defined more narrowly to mean people who are disobeying the law, knowing that they're pretty much knowing that they're violating the law without really a sort of justificatory legal theory, right? I mean, they may think that what they're doing is morally right, but they're cognizant of the fact that they're violating the law. So it tracks, I would say, very imperfectly with the category of civil disobedience. And the reason I say imperfectly is that we mean it to be a broader category than civil disobedience. So certainly the civil rights protesters, the sit-in protesters in 1960, understood that they were violating laws of, in some cases, criminal trespass, and they welcomed, right, the punishment that they might receive for that. But they thought that what they were doing was morally justified in terms of a higher moral law, you know, the sort of letter from a Birmingham jail, kind of natural law justification for violating the law. But we also wanted to go beyond that. We found that in a lot of the literature discussing disobedience, there was this privileging of that kind of conscientious, sort of morally justified disobedience to the law. But when we looked at the sort of movements of lawbreaking that have had impacts on the law of property, at least in American history, several of the most significant ones did not involve people who necessarily, you know, generated a kind of moral justification for their behavior. They were simply kind of pursuing their own interests or doing what they wanted, right? So one of the groups we talk about in a chapter in the book are the squatters in the American frontier in the 19th century, who were a huge group. I mean, in certain areas, almost everyone who settled started out squatting on federal land, in some cases on Indian land. Over the course of the first half of the 19th century, this was a crime. It was a federal crime to trespass on federal land. Over the first half of the 19th century, Congress enacted something like 30, I can't remember the exact number, but roughly 33 or 34 retroactive kind of amnesties for groups of squatters, right, kept saying, okay, this whoever's squatting now can have the land that they're squatting on at a fixed price, but no one else in the future. But they kept doing that over and over again. And then finally, Congress sort of tossed in the towel and granted a prospective amnesty, saying, okay, if you squat in the future, you can purchase the land at a fixed price. And then finally, in 1862, right, created the Homestead Act, which said that if you squat in the future, you can have the land for free, mm-hmm. As long as you do it in certain ways, and on certain federal lands. So, and those were not people who, when they acted, necessarily had a kind of sophisticated political theory about when it's justified to break the law. They simply wanted land, or felt like they needed land in order to survive, and so they took it. And then ultimately had this a really massive impact both on the law of federal lands in the United States and on the nature of land ownership in the United States. Because federal lands had been distributed according to the model that the federal government initially started out with, which was selling land to the highest bidder at auctions, we would have ended up with a very, very different system of land tenure in which probably throughout huge swaths of the country, we would have had, the predominance of large absentee landowners with tenant farmers rather than small, family-owned farms, where we ended up by the end of the 19th century. So we wanted the outlaw category is people who are breaking the law, knowing that pretty much confident that they're actually breaking the law, but who may be motivated by these kind of conscientious motivations that we associate with civil disobedience, or who may just be motivated by what we call kind of a positive interest in obtaining resources that they want. I'll let Sonia talk about the outlaw category, because that's more of the IP group.
Sure.
Okay. So one of the things that we were both learning from our discussions about disobedience and the trajectories of disobedience in IP and real property was that the trajectories of disobedience in the intellectual property context are so incredibly different. They're very similar themes in terms of the willingness of individuals to challenge kind of accepted principles of law, but the trajectories are extremely different. And I guess one thing that we can generally say about these two categories is, so in the outlaw category, you have, in some ways, I think the veneration of the civil disobedience, and then you have the denigration of individuals who trespass, individuals who might acquire property for the purposes of because of necessity or other legitimate reasons. In the intellectual property context, you have a similar type of embrace of individuals who innovate. One of the things that I've learned from my limited time practicing in the Bay Area is that there's a real respect and attention paid to individuals who engage in what we like to think of as disruptive innovation, right? Individuals that are constantly trying to use principles of technology to kind of advance and serve interests that the public might need in terms of acquiring content and so on. So there is this real culture, I think, that we see often in the Bay Area of really respecting the trajectories of innovation. But what that often means for the purpose of law and how law governs technology is that, unlike real property, where I think we all have a sense of what it means to trespass, we all have a sense of what it means to steal, in the intellectual property context, those boundaries are really different. It's very hard to tell, both because the law is so unclear and also because the property is so unclear. It's very hard to tell when someone is actually engaging in legal conduct and when someone is engaging in illegal conduct. And so much of the trajectories of disruptive innovation have kind of straddled both sides, right? Sometimes courts will find that innovation is legitimate and sometimes courts will find that that innovation is illegitimate. And so that's where Eduardo and I were constantly having discussions about the difference between real property and intellectual property. And I think one of the things that we both realized is that real property, that the standards of protecting real property are a lot more nuanced, and the standards of protecting intellectual property are a lot more nuanced. And so that led us to come up with this new category that we call outlaw, which is spelled A-L-T-L-A-W. So you have outlaw and then you have outlaw. And the reason why we thought a new term needed to be developed is because, one, the trajectories at the outset of disobedience are so unclear because the boundaries of the underlying property are so unclear, particularly in the copyright context. And also, when the boundaries of property are unclear, it also means that the boundaries of disobedience are similarly unclear. And so that's why we have very flexible standards, particularly in the realm of copyright, that are developed to kind of embrace and understand the nuances that come with challenging the boundaries of different copyrighted properties. And so you have, you know, the fair use test, which is a very flexible kind of four-factor standard, basically, where courts are asked to weigh different factors and then reach a decision. What that means is that not only is the property different, the disobedience, the trajectory of disobedience is also quite different because it's very unclear for those individuals to know whether or not ahead of time they're actually violating the law. And that also means that the outcomes are also incredibly unclear because it's very hard to tell at the outset how a particular court is going to rule on particular issues. So there's a lot of different kinds of considerations that occur in the intellectual property context that we felt needed and necessitated kind of a different way of describing them.
We're chatting with Professors Eduardo Penalver and Sonia Cotyo, authors of the book Property Outlaws, How Squatters, Pirates, and Protesters Improve the Law of Ownership on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU, and these are both not outlawed behaviors at all. They are very standard, legal, and as far as I know, not even subversive behaviors on your part. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless of your choice, I hope you consider making a donation to KZSU and continue listening to KZSU and to Hearsay Culture. So with regard to this idea of the outlaw, and I think Eduardo and Sonia, you've I think very well identified the contrast here. Is there, in your view, an optimal level of disobedience? In other words, in your book, you trace a variety of behaviors that at the time were actually outlawed behavior, and how those activities ultimately improved the law. Is there too much disobedience potentially in since we're focusing on IP, in the copyright realm? Is there an optimal level?
Well, I would love to hear Eduardo's thoughts on this. These are my thoughts. I am not sure that the book tries to define what an optimal level of copyright disobedience is. We try to stay away from trumpeting disobedience as, you know, a way that solves the world's problems when it comes to copyright. What we instead try and do is just descriptively look back over the history of copyright and identify moments where certain types of disruptive and potentially illegal innovation led to really productive shifts in the law. And so I would say that rather than thinking about disobedience as optimal or not optimal in terms of the levels of disobedience. What we try and do instead is just recognize that the fabric and the history of and the texture of copyright law reflects an understanding that there will always be different kinds of forces that might be construed as disobedient forces, and that those challenges that come from outside of the accepted boundaries of copyright law can be very important ways to develop innovation. And so I'm not sure that the book tries to answer the question of whether or not there's an optimal level of disobedience. What it instead tries to do is to say there are certain types of disobedience that have actually been rewarded and protected by the developments of copyright law. And I think that it tries to just kind of leave it at that by looking backwards through the history of copyright. But I'd be interested in hearing Eduardo's thoughts on this question because I think it's a great one.
Eduardo?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the one we are clear in the book I don't think at any given moment there's an optimal level that we can identify, right? But given the kind of inherently imperfect nature of our ability to craft ex ante sort of prospective rules that will govern property, that the optimal level of disobedience is not zero, right? That there will always be the need for some play in the joints of both tangible and intellectual property. And that disobedience is an important part of a process by which property kind of renews itself over time, by which flaws, imperfections, inefficiencies, injustices in the system are kind of brought to the attention of decision makers, whether they be owners or legislators or courts. And so that act of disobedience is an essential part of that. Of the development of property law over time and intellectual property, and that at the same time owners have this urge to say that all disobedience is bad, that no disobedience is justified, and that in fact the optimal level of disobedience is zero, and that tendency I think gets in the way of an intelligent conversation about how to respond to any given act of disobedience or any given sort of movement of disobedience. That's the sort of lack of tolerance for any disobedience it can be as much an obstacle to the health of property law as too much disobedience, right? And so there's a kind of Goldilocks nature to the problem.
In the book, you write on page 182 that rather than aiming for a complete deterrence in an effort to stamp out infringing activities, the law should instead seek a level of deterrence that accepts periodic disruptions as both necessary and healthy. So taking that statement at face value, are you attempting to establish a baseline that the law cannot improve without this behavior, that it is a necessary prerequisite to improvements in copyright law that there be these periodic challenges, this alt-law behavior, else we won't have the improvements necessary? Or is that overstating the case?
No, I don't think it's an overstatement. What I think that sentence was really aiming at is the fact that copyright law, because of the way it is so nuanced in terms of the way that the fair use defense is crafted, really does, I think, envision future challenges to its system in ways that perhaps real property does not. And so in order for fair use to flourish and fair use to continue to become relevant, it is reliant on challenges that come from outside of the boundaries of what copyright owners would normally allow. And so, for example, the reason why we the reason why we think it's so important to emphasize that point about the productive trajectory of this sort of disruptive innovation is, one, because the law and the history of copyright reflects that. You know, when we think about the development of compulsory licensing, for example, in the copyright context, when we think about the development of parody in the copyright context, when we think about the development of the Sony allowances for individual time shifting, all of those types of activities were at one point characterized as illegal from the perspective of copyright owners. Now you see situations where the law, in fact, the courts did intervene on behalf of the alleged outlaws, right? And the law really protected their activity. Now, the reason why we think that story is so important to emphasize is because today we're actually moving towards a regime that I think Eduardo and I are both concerned about, because the history of digital rights management, the development of digital rights management, has become so much more comprehensive than anything we've ever seen before, that in some ways digital rights management precludes any of these types of challenges from taking place. Now, it is true that there are some allowances, some very minor allowances, I think, in the law that allow for some types of fair use activities. But for the most part, the average on-the-ground activities that individuals might engage in that would fall within the gray area of what copyright law allows are increasingly being foreclosed by the phenomenon of digital rights management. And so it's locking, and so it's I guess, the concern that we have of kind of locking up all copyrighted goods to preclude all potentially outlaw challenges that we find most concerning. And so I guess if we were to kind of characterize the normative aspects of what we're trying to say, it's not that all types of disobedience are good, all types of disobedience are necessary. It's rather that when you allow private copyright owners to lock up particular types of content, foreclosing the possibility of all of alternative uses, you actually run the risk of stagnating the development of fair use in the process. And so that's pretty much the argument that we're trying to make.
Yeah, the only thing I would disagree with that Sonia said is that when she said that real property doesn't have, I mean, that it doesn't sort of embrace disobedience in the same way structurally. And I think it's probably true in the main, but I want to mention one caveat there, which is the doctrine of necessity that I think you could see as kind of the real property or tangible property analogy to fair use. And it's funny because I think property scholars have been reluctant to really engage with the doctrine of necessity. There's in Jeremy Waldron's book on the right to private property, he has this in his chapter on Locke. He has at the end a little discussion about necessity and says, of course, you know, necessity doesn't you can't have a system of property where people could come along and take what they needed if they were on the verge of starvation. And so necessity can't justify theft, or the system of property would just dissolve. And he cites to some British case law that essentially found that you can't violate. So you can't steal a loaf of bread. The being on the verge of starvation doesn't justify stealing a loaf of bread, which was some dicta in an English case having to do with people squatting. But that's not what the law says. In fact, the law says that that kind of need, dire need, overrides people's rights of private property, and that it's actually improper for an owner to interfere with someone trying to satisfy their needs when they're in that situation of dire necessity. So this necessity doctrine does, you know, sit there in the background as a kind of check on ownership rights It's obviously extremely narrow and has been kind of constrained very heavily by the courts. But the fact that it's there in the law of tangible property, I think, provides some insight into the need for a kind of periodic disobedience, even in that domain as well.
And, you know, Eduardo, that point's an interesting one, and it's something I wanted to get to with respect to, again, this comparison of real property and IP. The example that you just mentioned, stealing a loaf of bread to prevent starvation, the examples that you have running through the book, but including, as I mentioned in the introduction, as we talked about, the lunch counter protests that were aimed at giving basic civil rights to a good percentage of U.S. citizens, are serious issues that involved basic human activity. And there are those that might say, well, you know, a pirate wanting to get a free copy of Lady Gaga's new song doesn't have the same moral clout and moral imperative that these other comparable activities do. And you discuss this issue in some depth in the book, and I want to ask you about it, because you point out that piracy, as we understand it in copyright law, is far more complex than ultimately it's given credence, and that the definitions of piracy that we use may ultimately be inadequate. So what is the problem, as you see it, with how we define pirates in the copyright context as compared to the other areas with which you, you know, to which you compare?
Well, maybe I'll let Sonia jump in here. I think the problem we see is that the term is just defined far too broadly. I don't think that we justify or try to provide a justification for someone just, you know, downloading or you know, using BitTorrent to get Lady Gaga's newest single, you know, in order to avoid having to purchase it.
So we would certainly understand why people would want to download Lady Gaga.
But
are you endorsing Lady Gaga? Is that what I just heard? I'm kidding. Go ahead.
Yeah.
we just had an essay in Slate about the dispute between Harry Reid and Sharon Angle about his decision to republish her website after she, you know, the website that she had up during the primaries, which was had some positions that were more extreme. They may be more welcome in a Republican primary than in a general election. And so then after the primary, she took it down, and Harry Reid reposted the website pretty much in its entirety. And you know, I mean, she didn't use the word pirate, but she basically accused, you know, Harry Reid of violating copyright law. And her assertion was that, look, it's my intellectual property. He can't use it without my permission, period. You know, and so there is this tendency to, I think, overclaim intellectual property rights, and to use that rubric of piracy in context where it's far less clear. I mean, certainly there is piracy going on, right? But there's a tendency by IP owners, especially to be very liberal in their use of the term, right? And I think that's the problem that we're really focused on.
And I certainly the point of my question was not to suggest that that you want people to go download songs illegally, although you could certainly envision people that read this book thinking, oh, well, maybe they're saying I should just do this and it's okay. And of course, the argument is more nuanced than that. But it does seem like one could react by saying, well, you know, are we dealing with this? Let me ask the question a different way. Is the gravity of the harm being addressed relevant to your analysis? I think ultimately that's the question. So perhaps I'll ask that of Edward.
I think
Edward
it is, right? But I think that the gravity, I mean, there are two sides to this, right? I mean, when I steal a loaf of bread because I'm hungry, I'm staving off a very serious harm to me, right? But I'm also inflicting a fairly serious harm on the person who owns a loaf of bread, because that loaf of bread is no longer available to them at all, right? Now, arguably in the IP context, I had this conversation, I remember, with Bruce Ackerman, and he said, well, come on. I mean, who really cares about access to Lady Gaga? Or, you know, these are trivial concerns, right? Access to essentially cultural goods are trivial concerns. The flip side of that, though, is that the harm to the owner is of a different order than it is in the tangible property context because of the non-rivalrous nature of the consumption of intellectual property, right? So that when someone utilizes clips from movies to create a mashup or something, right? They're not taking away, they're not preventing the owner of that intellectual property from enjoying their intellectual property in the same way that I am if I steal a loaf of bread to satisfy my hunger. So I think the harm is, the stakes are lower in a sense on both sides in the intellectual property context.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I totally agree with that, Eduardo. And I think that, you know, it is really easy, I think, to look at the title or look at, you know, the stories that we tell in the book and think that what we are advocating is a type of lawless behavior. But actually, I think you're entirely right, Dave. The argument that we're making is a lot more nuanced. It is an argument that, you know, that really, I think, in many ways vindicates the laws of intellectual property and real property, precisely because we see how the design of those principles has both understood and in some ways really advocated for the kind of disruptive innovation that is so essential to the flourishment of, different markets, particularly when we're talking about content dissemination. For example, I mean, Tim Wu has done some wonderful work looking back over the history of compulsory licensing in the copyright context and really draws attention to the way in which the kind of rhetoric of piracy circulated in those discussions and how, in fact, courts did regularly step in. Sometimes they stepped in on the sides of the disobedient innovators, and sometimes they stepped in on the side of the intellectual property owners. So it is important to just understand that the story that we're telling isn't about disrespecting the rule of law. It's actually a story about protecting the rule of law and just demonstrating that certain types of challenges have actually improved it.
We're chatting.
Point I wanted to make just before we move on from this is that I guess there are, you know, I should have said there are categories of intellectual property that activate these concerns about human survival in the same way that that stealing food does. You know, the whole area of pharmaceutical patents, which we discuss at length in the book, I think is one where the stakes are just as high in the IP context as they are in the tangible property context from the consumer standpoint. Not from the owner's standpoint necessarily.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to. And of course, we're now at the point in the show, by the way, where I start asking the unfair questions, and they're unfair because we have about 5 minutes left. And so what winds up happening is I do have to cut it short quickly. And so what I'll ask in light of that comment, which I wanted to get to, I'll ask this question. Given the fact that that there is a general, I think, public opinion that what we're talking about here is, you know, illegally downloading Lady Gaga's songs as opposed to patents potentially for life-saving drugs, or in the copyright context, the dissemination of information into societies that are very closed, where freedom of speech is not only circumscribed, it's non-existent. What should the law do about outlaws? How should the law address them? And again, it's the unfair time, so I'll ask each of you to address it in probably a minute or a half. And Sony, I'll start with you.
What should the law do in terms of outlaws or outlaws?
Your term, outlaws. Yeah.
Great. I think that what we advocate for is actually not some huge, significant shift in the way that the law already operates. I think that what we argue for normatively is a real attention for and respect to the way that fair use has operated in the past and the way that it can operate in the future. I think the one thing that Eduardo and I both were fairly concerned about is a growing tendency that we see both in statutory law and in in some other principles to really honor the type of foreclosure that I think certain types of digital rights management develops. So, for example, anti-circumvention provisions that, you know, in some ways really impinge on an individual's fair use rights. Certain types of criminal penalties that are extraordinarily high. Those are the kinds of things that feel like are a little bit concerning, because we worry about how those trajectories foreclose that really important strain of protection that comes from fair use. And so in the book, we talk about different doctrines that could be useful, declaratory judgments, which you certainly see many wonderful work, many wonderful cases being worked on by Stanford's clinic. And so I think, you know, there is a real cause for optimism in the future, particularly because we do see courts pulling back on really honoring the claims, the open-ended claims of intellectual property owners.
Eduardo?
Yeah, I think the thing that you see, and I believe this is more of a problem in IP than in the law of tangible property, is a kind of systematic imbalance in power between owners and consumers or users, and even creators, really. I mean, on the one side, I would say the most valuable intellectual property is pretty uniformly owned by the largest multinational corporations in the world, who have enormous resources to litigate and can take the long view in litigation. So they'd be willing to litigate when they think they might lose or to make a point, you know, and just the cost of litigation can be crippling for a normal individual. And so, you know, I think what that translates into, you know, is a tendency for their interpretation of intellectual property law and the scope of fair use to become, in effect, the law as you experience it, or you and I experience it. And so in the book, we talk a little bit about one thing the law could possibly do is to try to restructure that imbalance, you know, to try to create disincentives for overclaiming. And this has been, there's a sort of a fairly recent genre in intellectual property scholarship of people talking about this worry about, you know, fraudulent or just false claims of intellectual property ownership, but also, you know, overclaiming in terms of denying fair use. And the need to create some disincentive for IP owners to do that, at least at the outer boundaries, and perhaps some, you know, some mechanism for recoupment of legal costs by people who are hauled into court and ultimately prevail. So we worry about that. We're really focused on the dialogue between the disobedient actor and the owner, and the law playing the role of mediating that dialogue and kind of trying to structure the law so that it doesn't kind of reflexively end up favoring the owner in the long run.
The book is Property Outlaws, How Squatters, Pirates, and Protesters Improve the Law of Ownership. The author is joining us today, Eduardo Penalver, professor at Cornell Law School, and Sonia Katyal, professor at Fordham Law School. Time is short, and unfortunately we are out of time. I definitely invite you back to continue the discussion. I think this has been terrific, but I want to thank you, Eduardo and Sonia, for joining us today on Hearsay Culture and discussing your wonderful book.
Thanks, David.
Thank you so much. The questions were really wonderful, and we really enjoyed it as well.
Thank you kindly. I'm very excited to mention a number of guests coming up on the show, people to round out the remaining time that we have this quarter. Among the guests coming up, Professor Rob Frieden from Penn State's College of Communication, discussing winning the Silicon Sweepstakes. Professor Oded Shenkar of Ohio State University's Fisher College of Business, author of the book Copycats. Associate Dean Michael Madison of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, discussing his works on the commons. And rounding out the summer quarter, Evgeny Morozov of Foreign Policy, and author of the book How Dictators Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the web. The show will then be in hiatus for a few weeks during the interim period, and I'm looking forward to a number of exciting guests coming up in the fall, including Dr. Grant McCracken of MIT, author of Chief Culture Officer, Professor Siva Vaidyanathan of the University of Virginia, author of the forthcoming book, The Googleization of Everything, and Professor Becky Eisenberg of the University of Michigan Law School. As always, you have a number of ways that you can listen to the show. You can pick up the show by going to KZSU-FM for Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time and listening live. You can also stream the show at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show by podcast, and I should have mentioned that this show is being recorded on July 16th. The show is available by podcast after it airs on KZSU by going to hearsayculture.com or by going to Stanford Law School Center for Internet Society iTunes page, where you can find not only Hearsay Culture but other events at CIS. You can also pick up the show by RSS feed from CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you very much for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.